Welcome to the Pro-Life Action League series, Converted from Abortion Provider to Pro-Life Activist. In the following talk, Ruth Yorston tells the story of how she quit her job at an abortion clinic and became a pro-life activist.
Good morning. It is a privilege to be here this morning. It is a privilege to share with you how I got from point A to point B. 3 feet is not a long distance. Many of us could probably take a 3-foot step if we just stretched our legs enough to do it. That is about the width of the sidewalk in front of Fort Wayne Women's Health Organization. And for me, 3 feet represents not just the width of a sidewalk, but it represents the chasm that I stepped across. I grew up, as Tony shared with you, I grew up in a family that was very strongly pro-abortion. And I want to share with you today a couple things. I want to share with you some background of my family and who we were in our community. And I want to share with you a background of my faith and how that played a part into the choices and the decisions that I made in my early 20s. And I want to share with you a message of what we do now. How do we help people like me? How do we help people like the other 6 people who were here to share their stories with you? Because helping people like us is a really, really important part of the pro-life movement. If we want to bring an end to abortion, one of the things that we need to do is to help the abortion worker, to love the abortion worker, and to understand how in the world we ever made the decisions and the choices that we've made, to find ourselves in the place that we found ourselves, to be in the midst of such great darkness and still somehow manage to breathe. So that's what I want to do today. I grew up in a dysfunctional household. That probably doesn't surprise most of you. I know that won't surprise the other abortion workers who are here today. I'm a daughter of an alcoholic. Who is the son of an alcoholic? My mother was the daughter of an alcoholic. My father stopped drinking when I was 5 years old, and because of my mom's protection, I never once saw my father with a drink in his hand. But that shaped so much of our family. It shaped who we were as people. Alcoholic families keep secrets, and we kept many, many secrets even after my father stopped drinking. He was a broken man, and my mom is a broken woman, like we all are. But the brokenness in our family was a brokenness that brought so much silence into our family. An inability to talk and share on a personal level, on an emotional level. We were an intelligent family. We were the family that talked about all the things you're not supposed to talk about over dinner. We talked about politics regularly. We never spoke about the weather in my family. It was whatever it was outside, and who cares beyond that. We talked about politics. I was expected at a very young age to have opinions and thoughts on things that I didn't know about, but that was how we were raised. So being thoughtful, intelligent people was very important to my family. My parents were children of the Depression. My mom grew up on the family farm in a little mining town, actually just north of Pittsburgh. And she was very much a child of the Depression. But she did something that no one else in her family had done. She left that little town, and she put herself through college. And she went to school at Kent State in Ohio. And my mom she loved Ohio. I grew up in Indiana, but she was, funny enough, she was a Buckeye fan. When I moved to Columbus, she was very, very happy. Go Bucks. That was, I don't know how she got there. But my mom graduated with a degree in zoology, and she worked in the medical field. She took a position working at Mount Sinai hospital in Cleveland, working with a doctor who was doing cutting-edge cancer research. And she assisted him for 10 years doing advanced research in leukemia. She met my father when she was in her mid-20s, a number of years into her career, and she was a very highly respected woman in her career. She met my father, they fell in love, and they got married, and she did what many children of alcoholics did. She married a man who was very much like her father. And she loved my dad. I found out after my parents' deaths, the great and amazing love story that was my parents' marriage. But we never saw that at home. It wasn't until we saw the love letters that my dad wrote to her that we understood how deep and abiding my father's love for my mother was. And it was an amazing story. My mom left her job in cancer research when she married my father to start a family. Because my parents were traditional in that they believed that they wanted to start a family and that mom should care for the children. They moved to the East Coast. My mother was offered a job at Yale Medical School and turned it down because she would rather be my mom than work at Yale. I had an amazing mother. I adored my mother. I had an amazing father. My dad is the most brilliant man that I've ever met. He was a member of Mensa, which is an organization of certified geniuses. That did not fall to me. He was a brilliant man. He was a chemist. He was a physicist. He had an activist's heart. And my dad put his mouth and his time and his money on the line to fight for those things that he believed in. And my mom did the same thing. And that's how we were raised to be. We were raised to not be the silent minority or the silent majority. We were raised to fight for those things in which we believed. And that's what my parents did. Sharing so much of my parents' story because you can't separate the child from the parent. It's how I came to be the person I am. We lived, when we moved to Indiana, we lived in a community just outside, in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was the second largest city in Indiana, but nothing outside of Indianapolis is all that large, so it's a pretty small city. And my parents, feeling so much that education was important, when they discovered that there really wasn't a good, strong school system, and certainly the one that we lived in wasn't a very strong school system, they decided they needed to do something about it. So my stay-at-home mom, who loved to knit and do crafts and cook and bake and all those things that moms do, and with this homeroom mom and was always volunteering and taking us to ballet and piano and flute and trumpet and all those lessons that we took, my mom decided to run for the school board. And she was the first woman to be elected to the Northwest Island County School Board. My mom started breaking the glass ceiling for women in my community and doing things that women didn't do. Women didn't sit on the school board. Women didn't hire superintendents and principals and fight the men in the community to say, our children are worth more and our children deserve a better education than what they're getting so that we can provide opportunities for our children. My brother Ken has the privilege of looking at his high school diploma and seeing his mother's signature on his diploma. How cool is that? It is awesome. My mom was an amazing woman. Who little did I know, because we never talked about abortion. It was just one of those things. It's funny, we talked about all sorts of controversial subjects, but I never remember talking about abortion. And I never realized until she took a job at an abortion facility that we were pro-choice or pro-abortion. But there was just this kind of sense, you know, that we had to be strong people and we took control of our lives and we made our own choices to make our own way in our world. My parents were the people who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and we were expected to do the same thing. And for my parents, an unplanned or an unwanted pregnancy was something that would hold someone back. So my mom took this job working at Fort Wayne Women's Health Organization. I was in high school at the time. And it came about after there was a debate in my high school English class. And my high school English teacher, when we were studying debate, invited two women to come in and speak on the issue. And one of them was the executive director of the Fort Wayne Women's Health Organization, Dee Doomling. And the other one was someone, honestly, I don't remember her name, but she was leading the pro-life work, some of the pro-life work in Fort Wayne. And there was such an uproar in the school about these people coming in to talk to students about life issues, that when I found out my parents were pro-abortion is when my dad wrote a letter to my English teacher saying how glad he was that his daughter had an opportunity to hear the truth about abortion. And how glad he was that in his daughter's English class that she got to learn that abortion is just fine and it's a normal part of life. It's a good choice and a right decision, and that he wanted his daughter to have the opportunity to kill her child. Of course, he didn't say it that way. To kill her child should she be given that opportunity. Then it was the op-ed article in the local newspaper with my dad's name and picture about how abortion was a right that a woman should have. And then it was my mom's trip to Washington, D.C. to participate in a feminist march. And I have a picture of my mom wearing it was during the ERA days, you know, wearing the bright yellow women, equal rights for women, and wearing a pin of the bloody hanger. This is how I found out that, oh, I guess I'm pro-choice. So like most children, I followed in my parents' footsteps. Parents are, you know, your job is to teach your children how to think. One of your jobs is to teach your children how to think. Not surprisingly, my parents taught me how to think, and I thought like they did. I was not that rebellious child who fought my parents in that particular area. I just went along with the ride. And I bought hook, line, and sinker, everything that I started being taught about life, or the lack of life. And I didn't think beyond that. I believed what I was told, but I didn't think beyond that. So when I graduated from high school, I went away to college in Michigan for a year, ran out of money, and came running home to my parents because I couldn't figure out how to pay for college. Took a job working in retail, wasn't making enough money to move out of the house. I'm sure my parents were thinking, is this girl ever going to leave? And the abortion facility needed a receptionist. A mom came home, she knew I was looking to pick up another part-time job, and she says, why don't you come work with me? Well, my goodness. What daughter wouldn't want to work with my mom? The woman who was breaking glass ceilings, the woman who was fighting tooth and nail for women, the woman who started all sorts of things in our community and made opportunities for many. It was an honor to work with my mom. And I took that job without thinking. I once said I took the job without thinking twice. The truth is, I took the job without thinking once. But I didn't know what I was walking into. I went down to that building, and it was a two-story building. So much I can remember now that I think about. I remember, you walk in, And like many abortion facilities, we were on two floors. So the girls would come up, and as quickly as possible, you know, you try to separate the girl seeking the abortion from her support network. We did the same thing. I was the receptionist. So my job, I was the first person they saw. My job was to welcome them, make sure they had a place to sit, give them something to drink, calm their nerves. And that's what I did. But it wasn't too long, actually, I started realizing that I didn't know anything about what an abortion was, what we were doing. But I was also afraid to ask those questions. I can tell you that I worked in the abortion industry for about a year. I've never seen an abortion. I've never heard the suction machine. I left the abortion industry still not knowing really what an abortion was, the process and the procedure, because I never asked. I just wanted to be with my mom. So I'm working away, and I'm talking to women, and I'm taking appointments, and I'm kind of answering questions, not knowing what I was talking about, but assuring them that the counselor would be able to answer all their questions, and it was going to be okay. I never met the doctor, Dr. George Klopfer, who still does abortions in Fort Wayne, Indiana, over 25 years later, who lives in Illinois and comes to Indiana once a week, actually more than once a week, because he does abortions in Fort Wayne and he does abortions in at least one or two other cities that I know of. I never met the doctor. I never met the nurses because I never went downstairs. I would go to the door that led downstairs. And I remember looking down there thinking, I should go. I'm really curious to know what happens down there. But I couldn't bring myself to take a step to go down those stairs. And I remember thinking, it seems very dark down there. Now, in retrospect, I know what the darkness that I was talking about wasn't the lack of physical light. And I know now that God was certainly protecting me from seeing things that I would not be able to handle and knowing things that I would not be able to handle. And I'm really grateful that I've never had that experience. But I'll tell you something, not having that experience doesn't lessen the guilt and the problems that I have faced in making the decision, once I knew the truth, to leave that industry. As Tony told you, I was attending church at the time, and I was not inactive in my faith. I attended a little evangelical Mennonite church, a very small church, certainly a church that would consider itself to be pro-life. I was there every Sunday morning. I was there every Sunday evening. I was there every Wednesday night. I read my Bible every day, and I know that will surprise some people. I was not a nominal Christian at the time. I loved Jesus. I loved the Lord. And as odd as it might sound, I was growing in my faith. When I took a job at an abortion facility, and why did that happen? It happened because we never talked about abortion in my church. It was the ultimate of don't ask, don't tell. Nobody asked. I didn't tell. No one confronted me or had the opportunity to confront me. And we never heard from the pulpit. Now, we talked about all sorts of other things that you shouldn't do. This is very common, I believe, in churches. Am I right, Father Frank? We talk about all sorts of other things that we shouldn't do. In my tradition, don't smoke, don't chew, don't hang with them that do. We didn't drink, we didn't smoke, we didn't swear, we didn't dance, we didn't play cards. We didn't do a lot of things. And we didn't talk about life. So I was kind of a sitting duck. And that's why I ask you all to not be afraid to talk, because people need to hear. I was preparing to study at Fort Wayne Bible College because I wanted to study theology. I wanted to learn more about the Bible. I wanted to learn more about how to study and read and understand Scripture. And I was dating a young man who went to that school, who was a pastor, a youth pastor, at a church nearby. And after we had been dating for a while, I finally had the guts to tell him what I did for my part-time job. And we'd been dating for a while before I told him. Because, you know, a lot of us, at least my experience working in the abortion industry, we don't share so much about what we do for our part-time jobs, what we do for our full-time jobs. Some do and some don't. I was one that didn't. Because somehow I knew that was just not cool. So when I told Andy, he was shocked. But much to his credit, he didn't, you know, turn purple and green and run out and, you know, scream, ah, you know. He just kept his mouth shut and said, "Really? That's interesting." And he dropped me off that night at my parents' home, because I lived with my parents. He dropped me off at my parents' home and he drove a half hour away to where he lived. And as he has told me this story since then, driving home, he was praying and saying, "Lord, I don't really think you want me dating a girl who kills children for a living, and somehow this is just not what I want to be part of my life." And the Lord spoke to him and said, "You're right. I don't want you dating a woman who kills children for a living. But you also can't just leave without telling her why." So the very next day, he drove a half hour again to come and see me for maybe 5 minutes. Spent over an hour in the car to spend 5 minutes with me. And he showed up on my doorstep unexpectedly and said, "I have a little book. Would you be willing to read this? I don't want to talk about it today. But would you be willing to read this, and we'll talk about it this weekend when we go out for dinner?" Well, I said, "Sure, I'll read it." And after he left and I sat down, it was a little book that just had a series of pictures, the black and white ultrasound images of life before birth. And I saw for the first time, because, you know, at the abortion facility, no one was talking about life before birth. We didn't talk about human development. I didn't really understand what was happening as children grew in the womb. We didn't talk about that at home. This is the first time I'd seen these pictures, the first time I'd ever understood. And those scales fell from my eyes, and I was shocked. And I thought, what in the world have I been doing? And I was so convicted, and I was so grieved that I quit my job within the next week. I worked 1.5 days a week. So the next day that I worked, I went in and I said, "I can't do this anymore." And it was a very interesting day at work that day, because by that time my mom had elevated. She was full time. She had been part time, then she was full time. By the time she left the industry, she was the assistant administrator of the abortion facility. So I went in, and first I had to sit down with Dee and Helen, who was at that time the assistant administrator, and my mother, and explain to them, "I'm not staying for work today. Mom, thanks for the ride in," because we rode together. "Thanks for the ride in. I'll be taking the bus home. I'm not staying for work today. I can't do this anymore, because I realize now that we're killing children, and I can't be a part of that." And, oh, you know, the mouths drew open. Thank you. They were shocked. They didn't know. They didn't see that coming. Heck, my mom and I lived in the same household, and she didn't see that coming, because hiring that probably wasn't very nice. I should have given her a warning, but I didn't. And then I got to go home and have dinner with Dad that night and have that conversation all over again. And we were the family that we loved to debate, and my dad was not a nice debater. He was the guy who would go in for the kill. You know that kind of debater, I mean, who knows how to take your words and twist them to be whatever he wants them to be. He was really, really good at that. My dad did not lose debates. And here I was, a girl who all I knew was life begins at conception, and I couldn't kill children anymore, but I couldn't explain anything beyond that. So I was not going to win that debate that night. I was not going to be able to convince him. He just thought that this young man that I was dating, that I was just dull, doe-eyed, and would do anything that Andy asked me to do, and that's as far as my conviction would go. And he was convinced that, you know, if he could just wait it out until I wasn't dating this guy anymore, that I would go back to being the normal daughter that he raised. Little did he know that I was now the normal daughter, and that I was a daughter that wasn't going to go away. To my parents' credit, they did not kick me out of my home. They were really angry with me. But to my parents' credit, they continued to love me as they always had. We just disagreed, and it was a very uncomfortable place to live. But we lived with that uncomfortableness as I began to grow in my understanding. So I'm going to share with you just a couple of my experiences of what it's like working, for me at that time, working at an abortion facility. Our numbers were published in the phone book. We didn't have a private phone number. Anyone in the community who wanted to know where we lived could know where we lived. And at that time, the news was telling us that pro-lifers are kooks, that pro-life people are dangerous, that pro-life people want to kill abortion workers, that there were bombs everywhere. Some of my experiences include getting in the car in the morning to go to work, sitting by my mom, and as she would turn the key in the ignition, I remember holding my breath and hoping the car wouldn't explode. You see, the fear in the abortion industry, certainly at that time, was that great. I remember pulling away from our home and looking back and thinking, gosh, I hope that's still there when we get back. Because I was really that frightened of you. I really thought that you would do that to me. We parked about a block and a half away in the church parking lot who allowed the abortion workers to rent out their parking lot so that we could park there, and our clients often parked there as well. And so it was about a block and a half walk to the abortion facility. Now, remembering that I was a Christian preparing to go to Bible study, guess what I took to work with me every day that I went to work? My big, floppy, leather-bound, New International Version Bible. Marked up, highlighted, ribbons coming everywhere because I actually read it. I look back now and I'm grieved to think the message that I was sending to the women that I passed on the sidewalk. I got to work and that Bible went on the corner of my desk, where everyone could see it, where every woman who came in for an abortion could see that the first woman they talked to read the Bible. So if I read the Bible and I was there, Jesus must think that it's okay for you to be here. What a horrendous message. I'm so glad for the grace and the forgiveness and the mercy of Christ. Because part of what I told women was the church says it's okay for you to be here. And it wasn't okay. I'm really glad that God's forgiven me of that sin. But I carried that Bible. And the scariest part of my day was about the half a block that I had to walk in between the death squads to my right and the pro-life prayer people the death squads on my left and the pro-life folks on my right on that sidewalk. To the left and to the right of me. And there was no way that I could get to work without being confronted every day. Today I lay before you life and death. Choose today. And every time I went to work, I chose death. But I'd look at the escorts to my left, and they were kind of scary. I'd look to the pro-life kooks to my right, and I couldn't see that they were not protesting. I couldn't see that they were praying. I could see it, but I couldn't realize it, because what I thought about them was so deeply implanted in me that I couldn't see the reality that these were people who weren't yelling at me, they weren't screaming at me, they weren't raising their fists to me, that they were standing there quietly praying for me. But through the veil that covered my eyes, that's not at all what I saw. So I walked in between Every week, life and death. And I chose death again and again and again. And I walked up those stairs and I put my Bible on the desk and said, okay, Lord, how many will you bring to us today? It's a pretty sad life, but it's the life that I lived. And I'm so glad and I'm so thankful for my friend Andy, who had the courage to talk to me. There are a few things I've learned since then. Things about my family, things about what set my family up to be the people that we were. I discovered a couple years later, I think it was a couple years, much of my life at that point is kind of fuzzy in the timeline, but I learned at some point that my father had been married once before he met my mother. I learned when I found some notes of his as he was getting ready for my father's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He went through that 12-step program. And part of that program is the point where you actually share your life story. And so I found the notes that my dad had from that speech. And he talked about being married. Then he talked about having a child. And then he talked about meeting Ruth. I was named after my mother. And I went back and I looked at that again. I'm like, married, child, meeting Ruth. Married, child, meeting Ruth. That's not the right order. And that's when I realized that my dad had been married before and I didn't know it. And that's when I realized that somewhere I had a brother and a sister and I didn't know it. And that's when I began to wonder, gosh, this family of secrets, does my mom know that? Found out that she did. A couple years later, I found out that not only do I have one half-brother, I have three. I've met one of them. And the ending of my dad's first marriage was traumatic, as I'm sure you can imagine. It wasn't something that he wanted. But it kind of contributed to his inability to deal with us on an emotional level and deal with his second family on an emotional level. I found out that my mom had had a miscarriage in between my brother Ken, and I'm the youngest. After I left the industry, there was a time standing in my mom's kitchen and still trying to talk to her about, you know, why, how can you think that abortion is right? Mom, you know, you worked in the medical field. Certainly, you took embryology 101, didn't you? You did take something that talked to you about how human life begins? Didn't you? How did you not get that? I didn't take that course, and I get that. And she was trying to explain to me why she looked at life the way she did, and she said, well, you know, I had a miscarriage in between you and your brother Ken. I said, yeah, I know that. And she said, and when you were conceived, we weren't really quite sure. We weren't really quite sure if you were healthy. And I was really worried that I was going to have another miscarriage. I said, okay. She says, because you stopped moving for a while. And I had a rough time in the beginning of my pregnancy with you. I said, okay. Wondering what this had to do with abortion. And she said, yeah, so I had a conversation with my doctor. And I told him that I was concerned that you weren't going to be healthy and that you weren't going to be normal. I was born in 1964, to put this conversation into perspective. So this would have happened in 1963, 10 years before Roe v. Wade. And I told the doctor that if you weren't healthy, that we needed to take care of this now. See, I realized, and it took me 20 years to put that together. It took me 20 years to, I understood that what my mom was saying was that she told her doctor that if I wasn't healthy, that she would abort me. But I didn't put it together in my head until over 20 years later. I understood that as being part of what was the makeup of my family, of why we were pro-abortion, because my mom at some point was confronted with making that decision and making that choice. But what I didn't put together was that she was making that choice about me. See, I'm beginning to understand more and more how deceptive, how convoluted, how complicated this can become. Not because the issue's complicated, it's really simple. When does life begin? Answer, at conception. So what does abortion do? It takes a human life. It's a pretty simple concept. But for my family, it was not so simple at all. My family, my dad had three children who after a divorce, he was denied any relationship with. The reason I never knew my brothers and my three half-brothers was because my dad wasn't given an opportunity, continuing opportunity to be a dad. So he kept it secret. One of the reasons it was so simple for my mom to take that job working at an abortion facility was because she thought about aborting me. The reason it was so simple for me to follow my mom's footsteps was because she was an amazing woman. And I couldn't imagine anyone else I'd rather be like. I wanted to grow up to be my mom, strong, independent, intelligent, ceiling-breaking woman. And I followed in her footsteps. And this happened, yes, because of my family dynamic, but it also happened because of the silence of the church. Silence is not an option. It must not be an option for us. It must not be an option for us. You all know this, but there are people sitting beside you in church who are not pro-life. And I don't care how pro-life your church is. There are people who are not pro-life. And if you're silent, if your church is silent, you're helping to make it possible for people like me to exist. And I beg of you, make it hard for people like me to exist. Love us. Speak the truth to us. Confront us in love. And help us to understand that what we're doing damages us, damages society, ruins lives, ruins families and futures. Because if we don't speak what we know, we're part of the problem. And that lovely little church I went to, who loved me in many, many ways, who taught me the importance of obedience to the church, who taught me the importance of reading scripture and praying and loving Jesus, who called me to a higher place, called me to a higher place in many areas, but never in the issue of life. And if we don't speak about that issue, we're falling down on the job and we're not doing what Christ asks us to do, and that is to love the least, the lost, and the lonely. So that's my story. And I'm really grateful that God showed me one other thing. Coming from that activist mindset of a family, an Operation Rescue in the 80s was pretty active at that time. And there were rescues that were going to be happening at the abortion facility I used to work at. And I remember when I quit, I was like, I'll go be arrested for babies, Lord. Okay, cool. You know, I thought that would be a really cool experience. And the Lord just put the reins on me. And he said, no, you won't. not only will you not get involved in rescuing, he says, but you're going to be really quiet for a while and you're not going to get openly involved in pro-life work. And I said, are you kidding me? How can I not? And he said to me, remember the first commandment with a promise. Honor your mother and your father.